So here's my little story for you. Following your instructions, I bought a new pair of headphones and a microphone off of Amazon. It didn't fit the Mac. So I panicked and I bought the adapter that arrived this morning. It doesn't fit the Mac. So I am shouting at the computer in the hope that you can hear me.
Well, actually, bizarrely, we can hear you absolutely fine.
Yeah, you're clear as day.
I'm 40 quid down, but at least I get to see you now.
I have to say, you've always been the hardest working man I know in show business because you've always got your finger in so many pies. But tell us right now, the pies, the hats that you wear, because you've got multiple hats, haven't you? That's the thing. Yeah. This is for Tash's benefit, really, because I didn't tell her about you other than that you're an old buddy.
Yeah, I used to have hair as well. On the one hand, I head up the Playhouse in Weston-super-Mare. 664 seats. It's doing about 120,000 people a year through the doors. Does everything from Blood Brothers down to your tributes. It does about 300 performances a year. On the other hand, I produce a number of shows. So I do Channel 5's Milkshake, which I've got a long history with going back to 2005 or 6. But I picked up the rights independently in 2015. I've been doing that ever since. So just extended the rights. So I've got it for a long period now. So we're doing, this is tour number 2, which plays to, we're doing between sort of 90 and 110 venues a year with it.
Wow.
The next tour is going out. So we're in the middle of one tour, which has come to a bit of a halt at the moment. And then the next tour already planned for next year, which will go on for another couple of years. I've got a science show, which sort of comes from, it comes from a long history of doing science stuff. Some of the stuff with Mark. We had this long history of doing things like Brainiac and a big event called Big Bang, Science Museum Live and all that sort of stuff. And I took all that knowledge and created my own brand called the Ministry of Science, which comes from a Ministry of Sound CD, bizarrely. I was putting a Ministry of Sound CD in and thought, I wonder if there's a Ministry of Science. And that...
So you snapped up that domain name pretty sharp.
Yeah, completely. Well, what I discovered was that we're the only country in the world that doesn't have a Ministry of Science.
Is that right?
Yeah. So we have...
That might explain our current lockdown predicaments.
Wow. Yeah, indeed. But we have a Ministry of Education and a Ministry of Culture and all that sort of stuff. But particularly in the Middle East, they have Ministry of Sciences. So I managed to trademark the name and run with it there. It started with a UK tour. And that's now kind of bounced off internationally, and it does much more abroad than it does here. And that's been great.
What do those shows look like, Mark? I mean, I know from our history doing Brainiac, I'm assuming it's a similar kind of feel. But you know, what's the look and the feel of it all?
Yeah, so it's exactly like it sits somewhere between them. It's not as entertainment based as Brainiac. It's much more on the educational sector. But what I did is when I wrote it, I sat down with the curriculum and I looked at the Key Stage 2 curriculum. I picked out each of the syllables and they became a scene.
Right.
So in effect, the journey of Ministry of Science is the whole syllabus.
Do you have children of your own where you've like tested and trialed these on before? Was this just an idea that you came up with and was like, yep,
yeah,
going
I have one, but he's 16 this year, so he's no longer interested in any of it.
16, mate.
Yeah, he's 16.
Where's that time go?
No, 3 more years and I've paid the finance off and I own him outright. it's been like Bright House with him. I've been paying for him forever.
That's hilarious.
Ministry of Science has kind of led on, and then do all sorts of weird and wacky things in the STEM world now. Like I've just, back end of last year, I got a random email from a man in Saudi Arabia that I kept ignoring. I just thought it was junking. I kept ignoring it. And he kept coming back. And then one night at 11 o'clock, I engaged in it and emailed him back. And it led on to me writing and developing a show for the Science Museum in Saudi Arabia.
Wow.
That was an interesting experience.
Yeah, I'm sure.
we sent out. I kind of wrote the script from a blank piece of paper, developed all the props over here with our friends up in Leeds who are no more, sent all of that out, worked out how to actually ship stuff into Saudi, which is not an easy process. And then we sent out a team and we trained them to run with it. So they now run it in the museum with their internal teams. We taught them about science, the safety and everything else. Wow.
And sending out shows to the Middle East and the Far East that you know, one of the hallmarks is you blow shit up, is quite a complicated thing because they're not keen on explosions in the Middle East and the Far East. And trying to take pyrotechnics over there is a little tricky, I seem to remember.
Yeah. Well, obviously, so I put Ministry of Science, although some of the others have now gone off and done it and actually kind of stolen the idea, I put Ministry of Science onto P&O Cruises for the first time. And that was pretty intense. I mean, you know, talking to these people about these ships that are worth hundreds of millions of pounds, and they go, "You're going to bring what onto my ship?" You know, that was an interesting process, having to lead them through that. And literally, at every step of the journey, we got hit with another hurdle. And then on the first time we were going onto the ship, we got as far as dockside. And the dock controller commander guy was like, he saw the gases coming off and he was like, you ain't put them on the ship, mate. He was like, well, we are. Someone's agreed it in the office. And it went round and round in circles. But, you know, it was all from trying to get it into the Middle East that kind of led the blueprint as such to be able to put you on P&O. But that was an interesting process. And I've done things, developed a science show for the Hong Kong Science Museum a couple of years back. Done some stuff with the British Council, Croucher Foundation, who are also in Hong Kong. We've done Ministry of Science has got a franchise now in South Korea, so we work with them. It goes out to the Middle East annually, and it does all sorts of weird things.
I have to say, I take my hat off to you because I joked about the fact you've got, you know, you're running the venues and you're a producer, but you're also the creative, the artistic vision. You're the writer, you're the director. Very often, you've got a very clear understanding of the technology. I mean, you can put your own QLab files together and run playback and do the lighting. You kind of very much take on that whole tranche of work, don't you?
That's the only way I grew Ministry of Science, you know, because I didn't have the money to do it. I kind of grew it organically, but it literally, you know, that first launch event, I managed to partner up with an event in Northern Ireland called Culture Tech, and they were looking for a science event, and I literally agreed to it before I knew what it was. They contacted me and said, "Have you got anything?" And I had this idea of Ministry of Science floating around, and I pitched them this show, and then suddenly they agreed to it, and I was like, God, I mean, now I've got to work out what it is. But that, you know, that first year and a half, be it, you know, we did things like Victoria Park in London for the council, a small event that was on a tiny little stage. I'd rock up myself. I mean, you know, I built the QLab files. I did all the stage management. I did all the production management, did everything myself, par actually perform it with two performers because it was the only way I could grow it. And then every time I got another show or another event to do, I just kept pumping that money back in. And now it's, you know, it's grown. I mean, visually it's quite a big show now, but it's grown organically over 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, amazing. That is amazing.
I still do the QLab files, you know, now through things like TeamViewer and stuff. When they get stuck, I'll take over their computers and manage QLab and do it all myself.
Oh, really? So you'll have a team out in, I don't know, Saudi Arabia, and they hit a problem and they phone you up and you can just jump onto your computer and you're sorting them out remotely?
Yeah, so I'll take over the QLab file remotely. And if there's problems or, you know, there's been times where, you know, initially I'd go out to the Middle East and everything else, but I've got the venue to run, so now I'll send someone else. But, you know, they'll get there and the sponsor will want their logos in or pictures, or actually they'll look at an image or a word and they'll go, "We're not happy with that." Or because we actually do Ministry of Science in Arabic now, so we've got full Arabic version. Arabic presenters who will go out with the UK team, and we'll have more people on the stage. So the UK team will deliver the demonstrations, but the kind of public facing side of it, the communication side of it, the script will be led by the Arabic team. So what it does is we'll do sort of four shows a day, and two of them will be to an Arabic audience and two of them will be to an English audience, expats or people that kind of have English as a secondary language. Mm. And we'll perform both. So it gives us the flexibility to be able to do kind of a wider spectrum of people locally.
That's amazing. So when you meet people at a cocktail party and they say, so what do you do for a living, given all these hats you're wearing, how are you introducing yourself to people at the first time?
I work in an office, because otherwise the conversation's too long.
And that office is based, you're based at the theatre in Weston. Is that kind of home base for you?
So Weston's the home base, but that's, you know, when I'm there, I focus solely on the theatre. And then everything else happens
in the other 48 hours a week you have to spare.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, I'm still, it's still working sort of 15, 16 hour days and regularly do. Mm-hmm. But you know, like it's getting easier because things are sort of fixed now. And there's so many different, you know, Milkshake now runs itself pretty much, you know, but there's still, it's all the unexpected problems, you know, as you know, from having a tour of that size. And predominantly a lot of the people on the road with Milkshake are younger. So they're still, the cast particularly, outside of the presenters, that are still sort of learning their craft. So there's still a lot of stuff on there, but got some.
And then there must be some comedy stories about when big shows go wrong in foreign countries, because I just think that particularly the kind of brands that you're doing and the kind of products that you're doing, there's so much opportunity for them to go pear-shaped.
Gotcha. Yeah, you know, some of the... It's little stuff, like, you know, I did a show where I'd done it just myself, and, you know, this was in the growth of Ministry of Science kind of growing. We started doing a lot in the Middle East and going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And I'd go out on my own just with two presenters, and these presenters were, you know, performers. You know, they had no kind of technical knowledge or experience at all. And you walk into these beautiful venues and they're incredible in the Middle East, but they don't have local crew or kind of head technicians or anything like we would in the UK. And they'll leave you to your own devices and they'll go, oh, we've got everything. Can you look at the tech spec? And you go, that's brilliant. And then you walk in the building and none of it's practical. And we had this auditorium. There was about 600-700 school kids in there. First show, got it all there. I'm trying to do the impossible because the Q-Lab show is kind of say and response. So your response to the Q-Lab's running a lot of visual and audio and all that sort of stuff. But it's responsive to what's happening on the stage. So the presenter will say, take a look at the screens now. Bang, the Q-Lab will fire. So you'll fire it on that command. Try being English, not speaking Arabic, and having the presenters do it in Arabic when everything on the screen is also in Arabic. I mean, that's quite a process to try and cue a show where, and you know, your two English presenters also on stage don't speak Arabic. Sure. So they're almost guessing what's happening front first, yeah. You know, so... when I wrote it, I sent it to a translator and they stuck it side by side. So in effect, you'd have a script and one column would be English, the other would be in Arabic. Sure. But you just guess because actually, A, it's not a language that necessarily represents anything that's on page. And they speak so fast, it's not even like you can follow it line by line.
You can't even tie into it phonetically because the script is so bizarre,
yeah.
Isn't it? Yeah,
it's
yeah.
so different to English. And is it right that they have it the opposite way to us as well? Am I right in thinking that they are literally symmetrically flipped in terms of their language?
Yeah, so after the, I was all confident. I knew what I was doing this first show, first one in Arabic, sat down there. I've got this script. I'm going to be able to follow it somewhere. I'm just going to wing it. It's going to be all right. Sat down, ready to go, ready to fire the cue. Turned to the local caretaker and went, where's the house lights? How do I turn the house lights off? And the switch is over there. So they'd set everything up in the tech box, but to physically turn off the house lights, it was the opposite end of the venue. So out the auditorium, down the stairs, into the stall, down the centre of the stall, to the left of the stage, flick the switch, and then get back up.
You're now also panto producing and becoming a bit of a noise in the world of panto.
Yeah, so Panto, well, you know, Panto is just a natural extension of what I've done forever because it is family entertainment. Mm. So, you know, the only thing about Panto is that it's if you do a branded children's show, you're creating that from scratch. There's a lot of kind of historical input to Panto in that there's very specific ways that certain things need to happen. You know, like baddies and fairies always enter from one side, certain lighting colours for certain characters and all that sort of stuff, which has taken me a little while to get my head around, because initially I thought it was all nonsense until people start pointing out they don't enter from that side, you know, it always needs to come on from the right.
Yes, because you've not worked in that tradition before as a younger man, have you, until you've moved into it as a producer?
No, so it was slightly my producer arrogance of taking over event initially, that when I took over the Playhouse, it, you know, it's fair to say it lost its way a little bit. It was hemorrhaging money, had done for a long time. And I was looking through the budgets and kind of the expenditure, and the obvious one was, we've got the show at the end of the year that creates all this money for the venue, but actually most of it's going to a third-party producer. So my kind of first job was to look at, how am I going to get this to balance? And I thought, well, I'm a producer, I've done family shows, I'll do it myself. So we terminated the third-party producer contract, and I produced the first Panto at the Playhouse as an in-house production. Because I looked at the risk and realised that actually, because we were advancing money to the producer anyway, to a certain extent we were cash flowing the production. Mm. So it was time to try it myself. I wouldn't recommend it to everyone because it's an interesting journey initially. But that kind of led on to producing pantomimes. And now, independently of doing Westerns and some of the Parkwood venues, I do the King's Theatre in Southsea, which is a beautiful Frank Matcham theatre. I mean, it's gorgeous. I mean, just...
Yeah, it is lovely.
If you ask a child to draw kind of their vision of a theatre, it's the King's in Southsea. Mm. I mean, it's incredible. It's very big. It's 1,600 seats. And I did the first one last year as a co-production with the theatre. And that was Aladdin. And we managed to bag Boyzone Shane Lynch. And we did that. And it was incredible. I mean, it was phenomenal. It did, you know, 38,000 seats. We had people coming back a second time and repurchasing tickets. Mm-hmm. And managed to take all of the knowledge that I've learned over the last 6-7 years doing it elsewhere and push it into one show. And again, what was slightly different is a lot of the pantos now, and it was something that I didn't like about Western initially, was that you were getting pantomimes that in effect were panto in a box.
Yeah.
You know, they were produced years ago, they were on the shelf, they were pulling the box off and sticking it in the next venue. And it never really kind of fixated on what was relevant to those people in those communities. And what I did with Western and then North Devon theatres and all them, when I looked after them, was actually start from a blank piece of paper. So we wrote the scripts, you know, and we wrote the scripts with local life in mind. It was much more apparent to those people that were coming to see it, because ultimately a lot of people that come to Panto are not necessarily your theatre going audience. What I wanted to do was make sure that there was something for everyone. So Dad, who was coming along to Panto just because he's
been forced into it. Bribed by his child.
Completely. Took something from that show. And actually that's been a real winning combination in Western, because the numbers have just, you know, they've just shot up, because relevance now is what people are seeing resonates with their daily life. So it's not just kind of shoehorned in references of, oh, you know, we're in Lewis today, and so we're going to make one reference to Lewis. The whole script kind of fits within their...
It's applicable, and they can find it funny.
And they do.
That's the tradition of Panto. They've got to be able to relate to something in their local area, because it is just local families, and they go time and time again. They go year after year. And it is one of those theatre shows that I can remember as a little girl going to Panto. It will always be in the back of my head. My first show I ever saw was Panto. It's a little step. It's a little gateway for parents to go, we're going to go to the theatre today. If they've never gone before, Panto is just like a little entertainment show, and you take your kids along.
Gateway,
it's
a gateway drug to a lifetime of theatre going, isn't it, Panto? And also, of course, the Panto is the lifeblood of most of our theatres. The money you're making at Panto is going to cash you know, cash float you through the rest of the year, which was going to have its peaks and troughs, of course.
Yeah, well, the, you know, it was it, that's how Western, to a certain extent, it went a long way towards balancing the books at Western by bringing it in house. Not only as the, in my opinion, the quality got much more better, you know, stronger. Mm. You know, the production values are better. You know, it kind of plays into local life a lot better. The audience numbers have gone up, but it's, you know, it, you retain more of the income. Mm. Within the building. So, you know, it ticks every box. But, you know, it was only because I'd done so many big kid shows that I was ballsy enough to do it, because it is that holy grail for theatres. You know, they're so scared to play with it, to touch it, because it is the one thing that's underpinned in their year. So it's a brave, bold step to actually say, you know what, we're going to do it ourselves.
Sure, sure. And of course, this year is a weird year because, you know, we're recording this in mid-lockdown. I mean, who knows when it's ever going to free up? And, you know, all of us in the industry, I think, are having that whole thought about how will we ever get the wheels back on our bus? And I think our industry is, because it's of its very nature, up close and personal, not just the audience, but the stage, you know, the rehearsal room, the actors interacting. It strikes me that in order for our industry to sustain itself, we've got to be back into panto season, hitting it hard this year because of the hit we've taken, you know, the hit we've taken over the spring.
Yeah, I think, you know, if we live through lockdown or there are restrictions in place by the time we hit pantomime, I think we'll see a very different industry on the other side of it, because theatres are relying on it. And at the moment, you know, to a certain extent, I would imagine a lot of them are still living off the cash flow that was generated at Christmas. Yeah. But it is, you know, it will definitely be problematic for venues without a major bailout if panto doesn't go ahead. And, you know, I've heard there's been sort of some conversation about potentially moving the time that pantomime is, you know, whether or not you actually pick up pantomime this year and shift it to Easter because there's free weekends over Easter. But I think it's, you know, they're all propositions, and as lovely as they are, you know, the reality is pantomime is that it's a festive experience. It's a Christmas experience, and there's no guarantees by shifting it or messing with the DNA of it that it would still work and generate the income that theatres need. It's interesting. It's a very scary time. Still working on the basis going ahead, but until...
I have heard through the grapevine, through somebody else who works along the South Coast, and they are very much reliant on their pantos, that they have sold out all their tickets for their most popular days. Now, they told me Christmas Day and Boxing Day, and presumably their New Year's Eve and not New Year's Day, their tickets have already sold out online. And I was just thinking about that. I had a chat with them. And I said, well, how are you going to work around that idea that families are hoping to pay for these tickets and go there? And then... What does that say about us? I mean, to me, it tells me that everybody wants to go to the theatre and they're seeing it as a thing that's happening at Christmas time. Certainly people that I'm talking to, they're still booking their tickets for things in the future or still preemptively looking at digs. I'm on digs list, theatre digs list, and people are still preemptively looking at their digs for potential tours. And there's a lot of like hearsay. I'd just be curious to know if people are booking tickets for you guys and your pantos as well, or is that...
So.
People were preemptive or...
panto, you know, you sell a percentage of your panto tickets over the current season, so people will as I said, you know, there's traditional in that you meet a lot of people that their family have come to panto for their entire life, and actually they still like, particularly in some of the regions, they still like to come annually. It's their annual family. They will sit in the same seats, you know. And in order to secure those seats that they've always sat in, they will actually book on entrance to this year's panto for next. So there's always a massive push to kind of confirm your titles and to get them on sale and to ensure that you're ready to go. And then you hit peaks and troughs with it in that, you know, there'll be times where panto sales will die down, and then you'll announce your star name and you'll get a little bit of
and then
from where it kind of starts to push up. The unknown about this year is that, if pushing back to Mark's point on social distancing, a lot of the venues are just not equipped to deal with it. So, you know, particularly, you know, one of the other points that's slightly being missed is age of building. So some of the new theatres are probably more capable of doing it than some of the older buildings where, you know, even things like DDA access, you know, access for people with mobility issues is a struggle, you know, to physically be able to social distance people in those venues. It's not even an auditorium issue to a certain extent, because, you know, there's a commerciality of it that actually you could cut capacity down, you could cut rows out. There's been many of these things kind of being pushed around, you know, every other row, taking out seats. You know, the commercial aspect of that means it probably doesn't stack up for the producers. So, you know, if you take a 600 seat venue and suddenly it becomes 200 seats, and
yeah,
you know,
is it even making enough to be able to afford everything else?
But social distancing in some of the older buildings is near impossible front of house, and that's the issue.
I saw a lovely cartoon for Panto the other day, which was a Panto horse on stage, but it had been, you know, person at the front, person at the back, but they'd split it, and the audience are shouting out, "He's 2 meters behind you," which I thought was a nice twist on, you know, Panto in the world of pandemic. It just made me smile immensely.
There's this old, there's kind of old routine in Panto called the 12 Days of Christmas, where it's done all over the country, where they go through on the first day of Christmas and they come out with a silly gimmicky thing. But if we do go ahead, I've been touting to anyone that wants to listen that I'm doing the 12 Days of Lockdown.
Yep.
Every day, just to give it a little nod to the fact of what people have been.
I personally am like screaming inside. Like, if I was the ASM on that show, I'd be like, no, I don't want to hear it. Stop. Day in, day out, 3 times a day. No, no. I'm like shaking.
5 sourdough breads.
No. Don't you start. Don't give him ideas.
In your venue at the moment, because you and I talked about this the other day, Mark, we emailed about it, that the venue's obviously closed and most people are on furlough now. So does that mean you're literally rattling around in the venue, you know, making sure the heating's still working? What's your day-to-day experience now?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's really strange. And I was only talking to a friend about this last night. It's the longer it goes on, the more bizarre the experience is becoming, because... It sounds a bit morbid, but the only connection I can make is like going to your grandparents' house after they've passed. I mean, it's almost eerie in that you're in a building that you associate with life and it being buzzing and you know, there being an atmosphere and people that you see on a daily basis, and then suddenly overnight they've all gone.
Yeah.
But you know the walls are kind of all over the walls. There's posters of memories that never happened. You know, it's all dated, and you've got March and April and dated events, and it's eerie. I mean, you know, it's quite a strange experience, and everyone's been furloughed apart from me. So I'm sort of holding the fort and learning a lot. I mean, you know, things like Legionella and, yeah, you know, all of those things that still need to happen to ensure that the building is fit for purpose when that time comes is being done. But it's bizarre. I mean, can I
ask if you've kept a light on your stage?
No, because I'm too tight to put the electricity to run.
I wasn't expecting that.
I kind of was, because I know him as a producer.
Oh, I'm so ready for a really sweet anecdote about how you've left a ghost light on and theatre will remain open always and la la la. And no, you're just like, no, I'm too tight.
I walk around with my phone light on. You got to say things.
That is hilarious. I love that.
Kudos to you, though. But I remember, certainly for when we were packing up our tour, when we went to do the props get out, DSM and I, and then Mark was in a couple of days later, it was pitch black. There was us fumbling around with the phone torch light, like you say, fumbling around trying to find lights. And it was just barren. Like, Fairfield Tools, anyway, is very ghostly and eerie because it's a really odd new building. Brilliant, it's a new building, but very oddly placed rooms and all sorts. We have to fumble around into cleaners' cupboards to find anything. And I just remember thinking, this is bizarre. Like, this theatre should be heaving. Even on our final performance, I think we had something like 40, Mark. Was that right? 40 in?
No, I think our final public performance was on the Monday and we had 90 in. And I have to say that was Yeah, that was the last round of applause that Tash and I were on a show together, and that was the last round of applause from an audience. But the applause at the end of it was very much both a "we've really loved the show" and "we're all in it together" Dunkirk spirit.
Yeah,
the next
100%.
Day we did a
cheers.
Performance to an empty room in order to film it to put it online as a show, for which, you know, the producers were very keen to do, and we all did it. But it did mean at the end, come the curtain calls, we sent the company on to take a bow to an empty room, you know, three cameramen, a sound recordist, and the writer producer, just to kind of clap, and then we kind of went, well, thanks very much, everyone.
So surreal.
Off we go.
Yeah.
You couldn't even go to the pub because we were all socially distancing, you know. So
yeah, it's a tragic thing, you know, like when you we've experienced this together loads, Mark, but when you've worked on a big event and it's been a part of your life for 6 months, and then you hit that loadout day when it's the end, and there's that kind of emotional tie to you that this has been such a big part of your life for so long, and you know, you all move on to the next project and everything else, but this is just, I mean, it's really strange because there's no kind of future plan in place of that. Mm. So you're walking around this building and it's there's a real sadness to it, you know, it's that life has just stopped. You know, and it's quite a strange experience to be in the building. And you know, I'm regularly in the building on my own anyway, because I'm very rarely the first one in because I don't like mornings. But I'm usually out. There's no show. But you know, it's different because now you don't know when the future starts again for it.
Yes.
And to a certain, it's a sadness. It's a burden because if you run a venue, it's a huge responsibility in ensuring that you kind of hand it over to someone in the future in a much better position than you've taken it on, and that, you know, your role is to ensure that it's there for the community, you know, and that everyone gets to use it. And it's not, although it's not your responsibility, this scenario, but the fact that it's closed at the moment, there's a little bit of you that feels like it's a failure, you know, that that under your guidance, suddenly it's come to a halt. And it's a really strange experience to be in there.
Have you found yourself with lots of downtime and being able to pick up any odds and sods of projects? I know that Mark has been doing some Russian and certainly some gardening, tinkering, and I've been doing odds and sods as well. Have you been up to anything funky?
All my spare time at the moment is walking around the building, running taps for Legionella. I didn't realise there were so many taps in the building. And, you know, the biggest regret was last year, the head of tech come to me and, you know, we were talking about energy saving and everything else. And he propositioned me to change all the taps to the push button taps that only release so much water at each time because of the saving we've made and everything else. Now, that's all great and wonderful until you need to do Legionella. Because the one set of taps that he hasn't changed at the moment that you can switch on, walk away from and let them run through are now my favourite set of taps. Because these push button taps don't do the job, or I end up having to stand there pushing the button out forever. I mean, it's just...
I'm loving that. I'm just having now visions of you in every toilet in your building. Yeah,
having a tap
bashing
crisis.
Taps to make them run through. And you know, that's just did you ever think your life would get to that point? And you've got to run them through to clear the pipes, presumably, so there's no Legionella build-up.
Exactly that, yeah. So you have to let them run, but there's only like a minuscule bit of water that now comes out of these push button taps. And then the other day I hit one so hard that it stayed down and then I couldn't get it back up. So imagine the moment I was having in this dressing room on my own trying to get this tap to run.
Right. That's brilliant.
All I'm proud of, 100% sure of, if the theatre industry never recovers, touch wood, I'm not being a plumber.
Well, listen, we've taken up far more of your time than we anticipated, and I am worried about your venue not having its taps run if we keep you chatting.
I done that yesterday. It's tomorrow, bank holiday Friday. I've still got to
brilliant.
Go in. Tragic.
Just brilliant. I'm going to have to rechristen you because I think I christened you Red Top Thompson all those years ago, didn't I? We're going to have to do tap turning Thompson now.
Yeah. You remember the Thompson tap at the Science Museum? The video where I filmed running through and my foot kept going out.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God. Yeah, I'd forgotten.
That That got me the Thompson tap.
We did a show at the Science Museum Tash years ago. Mark was producing it and creative on it. And I don't know what I was doing. Was I production managing? I was doing production managing, I think.
Yeah.
And but we, the Science Museum, which is a fabulous place, we, Mark, as part of the creative process, wanted to film a load of the presenters showing various displays around the Science Museum. And the only way we could do that without the public in was to go in overnight. So we spent a night in the museum. It was fantastic. It was totally cool. We had the whole museum to ourselves, and Mark was dressed up as a security guard at one point, chasing presenters away from...
I picture two young boys just running around, like... going AWOL in the science museum.
Well, there was a whole gang of us, and bless you for saying young. I mean, it actually wasn't that long ago, thinking about it. But I, my only recollection of it was I just went for the giggles because there was nothing for me to do, really, was there? I just helped carry the kit in for the cameramen, and that was about it. So I spent the most of my night just taking comedy photographs? What's a photograph? Comedy photos all night long. It was brilliant. But it did feel a bit naughty, didn't it, Mark? I remember it was we were locked in the science museum.
Yeah, 7 years ago now. You have to feel for the poor fella that's running their taps at the moment because they have a lot of permits.
That's brilliant. Now, mate, I can't believe it's been this long since we've spoken. And we keep saying we must catch up for a curry, but I don't know about you, but I'm having a more social interactive time in lockdown over Zoom than I ever did in real life. But let's really do the curry and beer at some point when we all can sit in restaurants again.
Yeah, no, that would be lovely. Definitely. You know, that's the one thing this is teaching us about, you know, staying in touch. Because life takes over, doesn't it?
On that note, shall we call it a day there? And thank you so much for your time.